Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How are developments in the auto industry changing what and how we drive, and which car makers are doing the best job at designing vehicles that give American drivers what they want? The annual auto show is among the best attended exhibitions at the State Fair of Texas, packing multiple buildings with shiny new cars and trucks, both prospective buyers and wishful thinkers. Automotive and business journalist David Bolt has also been to the fair this year. He's a regular contributor to the website Car Buzzard and other publications, and he's a past president of the Texas Auto Writers Association. He joins us now to talk about the highlights of the new crop of 2013s on display at the fair and dealer showrooms and interesting developments in the auto industry as a whole. Dave, welcome back to Think.
Well, thanks, Chris. I appreciate you having me.
It seems like a silly question, but compared to previous model years, is 2013 particularly dynamic?
Very much so. Yeah, the auto sales environment has been on a downer in combination with recession for the last several years. And while there have been bright spots, most of those bright spots are in those inaccessible price points that you and I may not be able to shop. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, the volume car makers are back. The domestics are back in a very big way. And the Koreans continue their momentum. And after the tsunami and the economic downturn that Japan itself suffered, there seem to be some bright spots on the Japanese areas also, or in the Japanese showrooms also. So for all intents and purposes, still hard-pressed to suggest it's running on all cylinders, if you don't mind the automotive analogy, but certainly doing very, very well. And for the consumer looking for cars, historically at the State Fair Auto Show, it's been very truck-centric, where they're going to find a good selection of new on both the truck and car sides of the showroom.
Lots of little cars this year.
Yeah, isn't that neat?
Feels like 1981 all over again.
I saw the Chevrolet, which you alluded to in your intro, has the Chevrolet Spark, which is one of the smallest, certainly one of the least expensive cars available on a domestic showroom. Starts at $12,000 to $13,000. I saw three kids, roughly 8 to 10 years old, literally climbing all over the inside of this Chevy Spark, suggesting to me it captured their attention and it's also accessible. And at a starting point of around 13, running to about 17, maybe a 10-year-old can afford it.
It looks pretty good, too.
It does. Cheap doesn't mean necessarily unattractive. Mm-hmm. And while minis aren't necessarily cheap, they were among the first to introduce the concept of small, sporty, and creatively designed. So the Spark isn't a mini, but certainly is not something you need to be embarrassed by. And that would be on the same Chevy showroom. They've got the Sonic, which is at a more $17,000 to $20,000 price point. One of the most fun cars to drive at any price point, and you can get it from Chevrolet.
So I had to laugh at this. When I was growing up, the next door neighbors had a powder blue Dodge Dart, model year probably 1973, 74, parked out in the driveway for years. I was excited to go online and find that the new Dodge Dart looks nothing like the old version.
Well, and I'm not sure if they offered in powder blue or not, but potentially they should. But I would tell you it's the first offspring of this Chrysler-Fiat joint venture, partnership, whatever you want to call it. But with Fiat as the managing partner in what we used to call the old Chrysler combination, it's the first tangible offshoot of that partnership. And it's a very, very credible automobile based on an Alfa Giulietta platform. And we don't yet get Alfa Romeo in the States, but based on one of the better compact platforms available in Europe, they've dressed it up as a Dodge and given it a price point between $17,000 and $24,000. As an Alfa enthusiast, I'd frankly rather have a $20,000 Alfa Romeo here. Mm-hmm. But from a positioning standpoint, that's not going to happen. The Dodge Dart, though, is one of the more credible choices. If you've got around $20,000 to spend, you want 40 miles per gallon, and you want something that's fun to drive.
Am I wrong about this, though, Dave? When I think Fiat, I think maintenance issues and reliability problems.
As my wife can tell you, we've owned some Fiats back in the day when they were actually selling them. And I always attributed Fiat's problems more to their dealership network or lack thereof than I did to the cars themselves. I don't think Volkswagen, which was selling 20 times as many cars at that point in time than Fiat was. I don't know that VW did a much better job of building the car, but I know they did a far better job of supporting the car. So while obviously people have had their fix-it-again Tony moments, which was the acronym, I also think going forward that Fiat is delivering a very, very high-quality product.
No more Saabs as of this year.
Yeah, and a shame, because Saab was a distinctive product. Even under GM stewardship, it remained a distinctive product. But They're gone. I think the name remains held by a Chinese consortium that intends to make it an electric car. But the Saab enthusiasts would argue Saab has been dead ever since the GM purchase of Saab, rather like Elvis dying as soon as he went into the U.S. Army, but which I think was John Lennon's line. But anyway, Saab is gone. Fortunately, there's a lot of other creative, distinctive, perhaps idiosyncratic choices that you could buy in lieu of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now. We have Zach on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Zach.
Hey, I am car shopping, and I've heard more about the redesign on the 2013 Accord from Honda than I have anything else, that they've really kind of stepped up the game in terms of not making it a luxury vehicle, but really breaking the creature comforts to it. Have you heard anything about that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Zach.
Yeah, Zach, thanks for the question. I haven't driven the new Accord yet, but I have a chance to walk around it, sit inside it, and read about it. And most reviews suggest the mojo is back at Honda with respect to the Accord. I like the fact that they've trimmed the overall length slightly, and they've got a sport model that contains a four-cylinder engine, manual transmission, and just some fine sport tuning to maybe raise the precision meter just a bit. Anyway, for around $24,000, that looks like a very sweet spot in that midsize sedan category. So I'd argue go drive one.
It's interesting that you say midsize. I was Accord loyal for years, and they just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger until I didn't want one anymore.
Well, and that, I think, would be could be said for a lot of people who are Accord owners or Accord enthusiasts. Some models of the Accord are classified as a large car right now, and this trimming of the overall length I don't think diminishes the interior volume, but does just give you a midsize sensibility that the predecessor didn't have.
You mentioned earlier, Dave, Volkswagen having been able to sort of support their vehicles with a lot of dealerships and people could go get them fixed, and now they've got regional headquarters in Las Colinas.
Yeah, that's very interesting and speaks not only to the reality of needing to sell more Volkswagens in the Southwest, which a regional headquarters will support, but also the fact that they're selling a heck of a lot of automobiles nationwide and have the resources to do that. But it is so essential, and that's something that I think car makers like Fiat took 30 years to recognize. If you're going to sell something the breadth of the U.S., you need to have a dealership body that represents that same geographic spread.
What do they do with the headquarters? They're not building cars in Las Colinas.
No, they're supporting sales, service, and parts. So you can get somebody, obviously with computers, you don't need to have somebody making eye contact, but in a lot of instances, it still propels the process forward better if you've got somebody making that eye contact. And you can do that from a regional location.
Okay, so what's interesting to you this year in the small crossover category?
I mentioned Buick Encore is the smallest SUV available in the U.S., and I think it debuts at the end of this year or first quarter of next year. But it's essentially designed on that aforementioned Sonic Chevy platform, so very, very tight exterior dimensions, a lot of height to gain its interior volume rather than width and or length. And so if somebody wants to sit up but park in a spot that is not much more accessible than a Fiat 500, for instance, could fit. It's a great urban vehicle to get around town and do it in a semi-sophisticated, semi-luxurious manner. That kind of speaks to me. Mini is not at the state fair, but Mini has a Countryman. They're a very, very small SUV that I think is going to continue to do very, very well in the marketplace because it has all of the Mini cuteness, yet a great deal more day-in, day-out usability than other Minis have. At the state fair is the Subaru Crosstrek, which is essentially an elevated version of their Impreza, which is very, very popular. By being elevated, it gives consumers, both men and women, a higher hip point for better visibility, a better chance to see what is around them as well as what's going down the road. And it sells for something in the neighborhood of $22,000 to $25,000. So it's affordable to a mainstream audience.
Explain to me the deal with the interior height. Now, granted, no one in my family is very tall, so it's not an issue for us. But, you know, you look at cubic feet within a car and you said, you know, they sort of make that up with height. Is that useful to many people? I mean, wouldn't people rather have hip room?
Well, in most instances, especially with the disappearance of the bench seat, you're not going to sit three across anyway. So that lower, longer, wider, which was the Detroit axiom in the 50s, 60s, really through the OPEC crisis of the 70s, is kind of out. And so with SUVs, you do go taller to get cubic volume. going taller gives you a higher hip point where you sit. And ideally, they've matched that with a greenhouse, the glass area, that's fairly generous. So you can see around you as well as down the road and behind you. Of course, they also have a host of electronic assists now, mm-hmm. whereby if you can't see it, you still have a camera or you have sonar that is letting you know that it's there. But typically people, even men, taller men, are liking to be able to get into something that they don't have to crawl down into or climb up. And today's crossover is that nice median whereby you can just kind of slide in without doing either one.
So I know this is not at the Texas State Fair, or at least to my knowledge it's not, but what do you know about this Google self-driving car?
I look forward to seeing it, and I recognize that there are environments in which that might be conducive. I'm not prepared, frankly, to give up my self-control in today's highway environment, but I also know that there are commutes that might be appropriate to it. It would be rather like, once developed and once the infrastructure is in place, I think it'd be rather like hopping into your DART rail car, mm-hmm. but it's your own car. And that's exciting. But for the most part, I still think people need to know how to drive. And I think going forward in the immediate future, we're still going to have cars that require us to drive them.
I have these visions of, you know, as a parent of four, just popping each of my kids into their pods and getting them off to soccer practice and play practice and wherever they need to go. But it does seem like, I mean, there's got to be a huge barrier to adoption. They keep focusing on the idea that these are safer than a human behind the wheel, but convincing people of that is another story.
Right, right. And again, I think in dedicated environments, you mentioned having a short commute to work yourself that, you know, could be bicycled or you could do on a scooter. I think in those environments, it makes perfect sense. If you've got a highway infrastructure that allows you to hop on I-45 and go to Houston and read in that 4.5 hours that you're going to Houston, there's a pretty good argument for that also. But in between those two extremes, I'd rather have the steering wheel and the control myself.
Do you think that when this technology is widely available, it will be only for the sort of luxury buyers, or will regular people be able to have these things?
I think regular people will be able to have these things in the same way that regular people can buy an iPhone 5. Mm-hmm. I think initially, and you're seeing a trickle-down effect with regard to the electronic assists. I was in a Porsche Boxster last week, which doesn't have rear-view cameras, but it has a sonar system around the car. And Boxsters have great visibility with the top down, not so much with the top up. So I wasn't relying on it, but I was still appreciative of the fact that if I've got a parking lot pole off of my right rear quarter, the radar is telling me that before I have to see it, because possibly I won't see it. So I think there's a trickle down through all of this, whereby the $50,000 cars have it today, and in 5 years you'll see it in $20,000 cars.
It's pretty exciting stuff.
It is within the context of what it offers. What I'm bothered by is the long-term ownership process. You buy an iPhone and you expect to replace it in 2 years. Some people replace it in 2 months. You buy a car and that's typically an investment of 5 to 10 years. I see some real problematical issues down the road in either repairing or replacing electronics that hasn't held up as long as the car itself will. So it's exciting, but it could potentially also be expensive.
David Bolt is my guest. He's an automotive and business journalist and past president of the Texas Auto Writers Association. If you would like to join our conversation about highlights of the State Fair of Texas Auto Show and the new model year, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
My name is Janet Manning. I'm looking at like a SUV because I have a an Altima small car right now, so I want to get into an SUV again. So I was looking at the Toyotas and, where am I, Hyundai? I like them all. My car is getting old.
My name is Asim Jalani. I'm just looking for an opportunity to look at different cars in as little time as I can, which, you know, this provides me. So it's a lot of fun. Kids are enjoying it. They get to sit inside and, you know, really have a good time, and gives us something to do. Look over brochures and everything. So everybody's really helpful, and it's good to see smiling faces. So it's just a good experience overall. When you're sitting at home doing your 9-to-5 job, not aware of all the new styles out, so it gives you an opportunity to, you know, come out and see what all the new styles are. And that's the big question mark, so that's what we're looking for too. So
my name is Ellen Rhodes. Yeah, I'm looking at a Prius. We own a Prius right now, so I'm just looking at the bigger version of the Prius, so because we really like it. I'm just trying to compare. This is the bigger one. We have just a regular one, and I just want to look at the regular just to see the size. I was initially attracted because of the gas mileage. I'm from California, so we're very green in California. So there's a lot of Priuses in California, so that's why, you know, gas there is so expensive, so Prius makes sense.
Audio there from visitors to the State Fair of Texas Auto Show, collected by our own senior producer, Jeff Whittington, who does quite literally everything possible for this show. So thanks for that, Jeff, and thanks to all those who commented there. It's always interesting to think about people going to the auto show, Dave, and sort of trying to decide what they want. Have you, over the years, figured out a system for seeing everything and sort of getting through the auto show, or is it best to meander?
I think it's best to meander for maybe the obvious, that you may see something that you hadn't planned on seeing, mm-hmm. that catches your eye. I went through it twice, one on the media day last week and then yesterday with a friend, and I was reminded then that the new Impala by Chevrolet, mm-hmm. which comes out, I think, in the first quarter as a 2014, I think. But anyway, it's all new, and that all new descriptive is often misused. But I came across the Impala not expecting to, having forgotten that it was there. So it's those little surprise and delights that are kind of nice. As a student of the auto industry, when it comes to buying my own car, I'm pretty much as confused as anybody. So if you are shopping or thinking that you'll be shopping in the next 6 months, it's still nice to kind of use a buyer's guide, Motor Trend, Car and Driver, Road and Track, Consumer Reports, all put them out. But it's kind of nice to go through that and kind of highlight those that you might be most interested in, and then try and stay in that one category, like the gal who drives the Altima Jeff interviewed and is looking for an SUV. Well, if she hasn't narrowed that down a little bit, she could be looking for the next 90 days mm-hmm. for an SUV. So it's kind of nice to focus on your budget, and that would suggest what you truly want to spend, you know, an approximate amount per month, and then find half a dozen cars that are of the greatest interest to you and target those.
So talk about Ford a little bit. They have really established themselves as quite the rainmaker when it comes to the hybrid market.
Yeah,
and they've got some new stuff this year.
Yeah, I was going to say, glad you asked, because I think Ford, all the domestic car companies are on a roll. I think Ford has been on a roll based on business practices as much as product, but finally that new product is also coming. Fusion is going to be a real bright spot in the midsize category, competing against that caller's Honda Accord that he was asking about. Fusion has always done well in the marketplace, but it's never been a car you could get excited about. Mm-hmm. Today it's a car you can get excited about. The hybrid version of it will deliver 47 city, 47 highway, and 47 combined. And Ford is rightfully proud of those figures, because one, they supersede the aforementioned Prius, and two, they do it with all the comfort amenities that you'd expect in a 21st century automobile. What I'm most excited about is the C-Max Hybrid. This is a mini minivan, which gives you that vertical height and visibility I was talking about earlier. It's not an SUV. It's a mini minivan with none of the negatives associated with minivan.
No sliding door.
You're catching me because I'm not remembering. I think it's a conventional door, mm-hmm. but what I would suggest is for a family of five that want to carry both people and things, there's no better way of getting around. My family with adult children 6, 7, 8 years ago, we did a tour of southern Germany in the C-Max that preceded this one. We had far more luggage than any family of four should have, and we traveled for 10 days in the car, burnt very little fuel, and I had a great time seeing all of southern Germany in the process. So it's a car I'd certainly recommend. And I don't mean to get away from the hybrid aspect or Ford generally, but whether it's trucks or cars, Ford has been hitting its stride, and going into 2013 seems to be doing even more of it.
By the way, I've been told that there is a conventional door on the C-Max by Jeff Whittington again, who has been
Jeff.
All through the auto show.
Thank you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Chris in Fort Worth. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Chris. Glad you're having the show. I work as an insurance appraiser. I go out and look at crash cars day in, day out. And, you know, I see a lot of horrible crashes that I really wish I didn't have to see. And I was just wondering, what kind of new safety features are there? I know you were talking about the sonar and the rear view cameras, but what other things are there out there to help people not get into car crashes in the first place, and also to minimize their risk of injury and whatnot from a car crash if it does occur?
Great question. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, that is a great question. Chris, I'm a big fan of active safety. And active safety, as you allude to, is the ability to avoid the accident in the first place. And that's why a demonstration drive in the vehicle that you're considering to select, go beyond the internet research, go beyond contacting a salesperson via email, and drive the car. Check on things like visibility, braking, steering, connectivity. In other words, can you drive it accurately, or are you turning a corner just by kind of suggesting that it turned the corner? So active safety, I think, is paramount. Above and beyond that, everyone has gained more airbags. I think it's Chevrolet that is pointing out a new airbag that is seat-mounted to the right of the driver and to the left of the passenger. And the intent is, when inflated, the driver and passenger aren't going to be colliding into each other in a sideways impact. So airbags proliferate. Better braking systems, including electronic brake force distribution, EBD, which is intended to better modulate the brakes under hard braking. Of course, everything has anti-lock braking systems at this point in time, yet a lot of people don't know how to use it. So I think the best thing is to prepare yourself to be a better driver, but there's proliferation of what they call passive safety on most cars today also.
I think a lot of families would pay extra for an airbag that inflated between their arguing kids in the backseat.
Absolutely. Yeah. And give it 5 years, Chris.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Luxury cars first, and then we'll get down to the regular cars. We have an email here from Steve, who says, any research that points to how buyers pay for their vehicle? Do people pay a percentage down on the purchase price and then pay over time, or save up and pay the cost up front? Do you know what the trends are these days?
Well, one trend I'd point to with an economic upturn is the return of leasing. Mm-hmm. In the downturn, leasing just, for all intents and purposes, went away completely. And during the downturn, when banks, having their own stresses, were taking more critical looks at finance applications, part of the problem with the auto industry or the consumer industry as a whole in the last 4 years was the difficulty of financing any purchase, whether it be a home or a car. But for the most part, and this is true since World War II, most cars are financed, but leasing is an increasing percentage of that process. I think very few car purchasers are actually paying cash for their cars.
Going back to this issue of safety, the one thing that troubles me, and I am not an expert, is all the electronic screens that are being put as standard issue into cars these days. The map I get, but all the other stuff I'm not so sure about. Is there debate in the auto industry about whether or not we really need a screen that distracts us from the windshield?
Well, there's debate in the industry. There's debate in the government. Mm-hmm. Our Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, is a very big opponent of distracted driving. I share Mr. LaHood's sensitivity. I think anything that you have on the dashboard shouldn't be a distraction to what you're about, which is driving. And whether it's my Ford Touch, GM has their own system. I think while they're trying to reduce, you know, our thumb action, mm-hmm. and keep our hands on the wheel, I think there is still something to be said for listening to an email that's a distraction relative to what you should be doing, which is driving. So it's a debate that's ongoing. I think the pendulum is swinging a little too much towards electronics, and I think in 5 years we may see it swing away and back to putting what's important in front of drivers, which is the roadway.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is David Bolt. He's a journalist who writes for Car Buzzard. He also participates in the Highway 1 podcast, which you can find on iTunes. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Bill on the line in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
Hi. I would like to question your guest's pessimism regarding the future reliability of automobile electronics. I just wonder what negative evidence does he have for that. It would seem to me that our experience has been that the reliability of the semiconductor electronics especially has been fantastic.
And, Bill, I don't disagree, and any evidence I have to suggest is simply anecdotal, but I do know that my wife and I typically hold onto vehicles for 8 to 10 years. We try and get the payment period retired and then spend 3 or 4 years saving for our next purchase. And it's truly anecdotal experience, but I know when you're replacing modules, it's an expensive process. I know luxury cars, which had electronics prior to affordable cars, if you're looking at a BMW 7 Series or Mercedes-Benz S-Class, the reason those depreciate so aggressively as used vehicles is the cost of maintaining them as used vehicles. And those aren't drivetrains that are expensive to maintain. Those typically are the electronic packages around those drivetrains.
I want to talk a little bit about electric cars. I think it was Tesla that I read is putting these recharge stations in place in California.
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, I think Tesla is in some sort of cooperative to get stations
all over the country.
But right, I think it opened up in California. And I think it was a guy by the name of Brad Berman for last Sunday's New York Times, so they could find it online, did a drive from Northern California to Southern California, 500 and some miles in a day, recharging on his way. Pretty exciting.
Is that the last impediment to really getting more people to convert to these kinds of vehicles?
Absolutely. It's the old range anxiety. And with today's commutes, some are obviously longer than others, but if you've got an 80 to 100-mile range that's realistic, such as the Nissan Leaf has, most people could drive half of the week without recharging at night. But there is still the, well, I want to run an errand after work, or can I get home? I drove a Mitsubishi I, which is their small, almost like a gem car, almost like an industrial shuttle. But it's an affordable $30,000 plus the incentive, so you could transact it at around 22, 60-mile range. And I was thinking it would be fine. It would be effortless. For whatever reason, I didn't do the recharge correctly, and it was on me, but I didn't. I'm trying to get to the airport as the needle's running down, and I have visions of being on 183 with a phone in my hand and late for a flight.
Nobody can give you a gallon of gas at that point.
Right, exactly. It's a flatbed for all intents and purposes. But that, to your question, that is the last impediment. And I'm confident we're going to get there. And we do. When we do, I don't want two electric vehicles in my garage, but I'd be delighted if I had one.
We have an email here from Marissa who writes, we've been car shopping for the past couple of months and are looking at buying a 2013 Accord. We have a 16-year-old son who is approximately 6'2 and still growing like a weed. Most of the cars we've looked at, including the Accord, don't have near enough headroom in the back seat. Can you recommend another car with similar features and more headroom, or are we stuck getting a larger SUV or crossover?
Well, I would suggest compact or midsize SUVs should be able to accommodate a kid that size. Most NBA drivers are driving Cadillac Escalades, or NBA players are driving Cadillac Escalades or full-size pickups. So if he shoots up to 7 feet, all bets are off. But in the interim, I think anyone that's tall ought to be able to fit in most compact or midsize SUVs if they can't fit in midsize sedans.
It's funny to think the word pickup has just come up 37 minutes into this conversation about the Texas State Fair Auto Show. But what's new in the truck world this year?
Well, we had a chance to drive immediately prior to the fair the F-150 King Ranch edition. Mm-hmm. And possibly the neatest thing at Media Days was meeting the chairman of the King Ranch, a guy by the name of Jamie Clement. So what is new generally is this drive to make luxurious offerings in the pickup segment. The $50,000 pickup is no longer a rarity. In fact, it is approaching mainstream in terms of its spec. Ram, which is a Chrysler division, was showing off their new heavy duties. Ford was showing off more luxury variants of the F-Series. And Chevy was withholding news because the new Silverado is going to come next year, and they're waiting probably until the Detroit Auto Show to share more details of that. But trucks continue to get more comfortable. Trucks continue to get more efficient. Ram is offering a 25-mile-per-gallon figure highway on their full-size pickup. Ford, I think, comes in with their EcoBoost V6 at 22 to 23. So we're not yet at 30, let alone 40 miles per gallon on trucks, but you can find trucks that you can drive with a degree of economy and I think a degree of clear conscience that you couldn't have done 5 years ago.
Are those luxury trucks getting garaged every night, and do they never haul wood or messy skates or anything?
The brochures would profess that they remain work trucks. I don't see that as being the reality. If you look at the interior, the chaparral leather of an F-150 King Ranch, I wouldn't want my kid to be crawling all over it. And if he or she was crawling all over it, it would be without shoes. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's a blend, and people use them in different ways.
Yeah.
But I think the best truck is still the $20,000 pickup that you can do anything to.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Steve in Dallas. Hey, Steve.
Hi. How are you doing, Chris?
Great. Thank you.
My question is a simple one. Candidly, there is nothing that drives me more insane than the idiots driving down our road trying to text and drive at the same time. And I'm wondering why the auto companies have not pursued a technology which will prevent the use of texting on your cell phone while in the car. The technology already exists and it's there. I don't understand why nobody is pursuing this, because it's dangerous. It's worse than alcohol.
It gets back to our conversation earlier with regard to Ray LaHood, the transportation secretary, and how strongly he's opposed to this distracted driving. I suspect it's coming. And you're quite right. The technology exists. Ford, to their credit, has done probably the most aggressive job of making access to technology easy and non-distracting. But you're right. It may take a mandate.
David Bolt is with us. He's an automotive and business journalist. You can find his writing at Car Buzzard, and you can listen to the Highway 1 podcast, available through iTunes. We're talking about highlights of the State Fair of Texas Auto Show and the new model year. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres October 16th with Chef John Haney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
My name is Frank Ortiz. I'm actually checking out these new Super Duties right here. They look pretty nice. I just like the interior. I'm actually a car driver, but I've previously owned trucks before, and I'm thinking about going back, because if I'm paying for a V8, I might as well just get a pickup.
My name is Michelle Chappell. I just wanted to look at Fords, especially. I'm interested in a Ford Focus, and I came here to actually look at one and sit in one without being pressured by any salespeople. I haven't had a new car in 10 years, so it's just fun. I love the colors. The blues are I'm a blue person. I love the blues. Just the colors are just really cool.
My name is Rydell Samuels. Well, I was interested in the auto show. It's really nice, and I was very intrigued by the American cars. I really liked it, the 2014 Chevy Impala, the style, and the features of it, and the miles per gallon on it. It's a pretty nice vehicle.
Visitors to the State Fair of Texas Auto Show, and we are here today with David Bolt, automotive and business journalist and past president of the Texas Auto Writers Association. You can see his work at Car Buzzard, and you can check him out on his podcast, Highway 1, that's available through iTunes. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have Angie on the line in Weatherford. Hey, Angie.
Hi. I just had a comment about the person who was looking at the Honda Accord with the tall 16-year-old son.
Mm-hmm.
We just bought a Honda Cross Tour, which is basically the Accord model, but it's a hatchback Accord, and we are extremely happy with it. It has a ton of headroom in the back.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you so much for that call. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion, and I'm sorry it didn't occur to me. The Cross Tour is a relatively low-volume offshoot of the Accord, but still makes great sense and is a good suggestion.
We have an email here from Harold in McKinney who wants to know about alternative energy cars at the show. We talked about some of the hybrids, but are there others we didn't discuss?
Well, I think one thing that is worth mentioning is diesel. And to be sure, they do not have the distribution or product offerings that hybrids do. But diesel remains a great argument for better efficiency. Most get 40 miles per gallon as a matter of course. Volkswagen offers them. Audi is offering them, although Audi is not at the show. There is rumored to be a Chevy Cruze diesel in the 2014 model year, and Mazda apparently is going to be coming out with a diesel version of its compact SUV, the CX-5, within the next 12 months. So beyond that, there is the Chevy Volt, the electric/gasoline car, whereby you've got 40 miles of all-electric driving, which should take care of most daily commutes. But if you want to go to Detroit, as I did, and just drive it as a conventional automobile, you've got the opportunity to do that.
Are diesels still pretty noisy?
No, they're not. They really have taken all of the stuff away. Mercedes is also a great proponent of diesel powertrains, but they aren't at the show to my knowledge. But no, they've really taken away all of the negatives, and what you're left with is a typically more reliable, because there's less going on, combustion process, and typically fuel efficiency that's a good 50% better than its gasoline counterpart.
Okay, so this is completely not important, but it's interesting to me. The finishes on some luxury cars that I've seen are matte now instead of being really glossy.
Yeah, you're seeing that on show cars a lot, and you've seen it on Mercedes-Benz. Hyundai is offering their subcompact Veloster in a matte finish. Really, really neat look because it's very 21st century. There's a element of hot rodding called rat rods, in which they do as little as possible cosmetically. And so it kind of speaks to that sensibility, if you will. Hard to maintain. You apparently can't take these finishes through automatic car washes, which would be the kiss of death for most people from a maintenance standpoint. They fingerprint. And anyway, apparently there's still some problems in offering it across the board on a wide range of vehicles. But very, very neat look.
Any reason why cars are never left with bare metal in the way that airplanes sometimes are?
Aluminum, a DeLorean is probably with stainless steel, the biggest proponent of that back in the day, and that really requires constant maintenance. For steel bodies, it's corrosion. And aluminum panels, while you can do it, you still have some aspect of oxidation that probably wouldn't be attractive in the long term.
So they look like junkyard cars.
Yeah, exactly.
Out of the showroom.
That's right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Andrea in Dallas. Hey, Andrea.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I read My Farewell Subaru, and in the story he talks about converting his diesel to use just regular old used cooking oil. And I was interested in looking at getting a car somewhere in the $20,000 range to $30,000 range that would allow me to make that sort of conversion. And how, you know, what is the potential use for that? That, you know, I realize not everybody has cooking oil around, but I'd have to work on that end. But I'd like to hear what your speaker has to say about that.
A good friend of mine does that with a collection of Mercedes-Benz diesels, most of them older. And a lot of people are into this. There's a conversion process. You just can't take the cooking oil from your McDonald's and put it in your fuel tank. But given the filtering that is necessary in order to accomplish that, as I understand it, any contemporary diesel can be converted to run on this recycled, refiltered cooking oil. And it makes a huge amount of sense.
I would imagine there are internet user groups of people that are really into this.
Right, absolutely. And I don't think you can assume at this point in time that you can get this stuff for free. It has a commercial value at this point in time, so you'll probably be buying it. And would I do it on my new VW diesel? I'm just not sure that I would without extensive amount of research. But it can be done and is being done.
So aforementioned NBA players notwithstanding, have we seen the end of the era of the giant SUV, the Cadillac Escalade and the Hummer and that sort of thing?
We haven't seen the end of the era. Hummer, certainly we have. The wretched excess I don't think is going to be done by any major corporation today. The Cadillac Escalade and its brethren, the Chevy Suburban and the GMC, whose name I'm forgetting, but the GMC derivative of the Chevy Suburban. They're built in Arlington. Mm-hmm. And that Arlington plant is being reconfigured for unit body construction, which is to say the big SUVs will continue, but they're going to be designed more intelligently with eliminating the body-on-frame architecture the traditional trucks have. And what that does, it saves something like 600-700 pounds of vehicle weight, which makes them more efficient. It opens up the interiors for better space utilization inside. And so we are going to continue seeing big SUVs, but they're going to be better designed, more efficient to operate. And frankly, I think they're going to be toned down just a bit from what they've occupied over the last 10 years.
What are the best hopes with regard to materials used in car bodies to make them lighter? I mean, we hear about development and we seem to stay with the same materials year after year.
Costs are coming down on some of the more exotic materials. Ford in their F-Series pickups are using a great deal more aluminum than they've done previously. And Range Rover is using extensive use of aluminum in their new Range Rover, which drops something like 700 pounds from its vehicle weight. So to be sure, you're going from 6,000 to maybe 5,200. But I think as these volumes gear up and car companies look for ways of meeting the government mandated economy regulations, you're going to see more of it because you have to see more of it. Things like carbon fiber are still probably the province of the very, very expensive small volume manufacturers at the moment, but even that technology is going to trickle down.
Will we still be able to have that satisfying solid thunk of the door as opposed to the clink of a really light modeled car?
Yeah, I think so, in part, Chris, because of the structure itself. Mm-hmm. It has to be a well-constructed, solid automobile from a safety standpoint, and so it only follows that you can get that solid thunk because you're going to need it from a safety standpoint.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
though,
I do.
Right?
Yeah. And it's interesting. You see, you're surprised sometimes by the inexpensive cars that have a shut that feels solid and quality-like, and some of the more expensive cars that, for whatever reason, have lost it. So it isn't necessarily the exclusive realm of an expensive automobile.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Brad on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Brad.
Hi. What is your strategy on getting into a luxury vehicle? Say you're okay with the car payment, but you want to miss that huge depreciation. So, and then you have to consider, like you say, the reason there is the depreciation is the maintenance cost. So what would be your strategy on driving a great luxury car but trying to keep your payments low and missing that depreciation and flipping it maybe every 2-3 years?
That's what leasing was designed for, and that's why so many luxury automobiles are leased rather than purchased. You know, you can typically lease something, and I haven't done the math recently, but a $50,000 car is going to cost you roughly $1,000 per month to finance, and historically would cost you around $600 a month to lease. Most of these German car makers especially are offering free maintenance for the warranty period, which is typically 4 years or 50,000 miles. So the only obligation you have to that car is that lease payment and putting gas in the thing. So if you want a luxury automobile, that's by all means, the intelligent way of acquiring it.
Thinking of lease resale reminds me of the question of what happens to the cars that are put on display at auto shows. Do they move from one market to the next, or do they get sold in the local market?
It depends on the auto show and the manufacturer. Some of them have a auto show fleet that simply travels, mm-hmm. and some of them are going to secure them in the local area through their dealers. So it depends on the size of the show and the manufacturer themselves. Can work either way.
We have a number of questions here about hybrid trucks and why we haven't seen more in that line.
The only people that have done that is General Motors with what they did called a very, very mild hybrid, and it increased,
mild hybrid.
It increased fuel efficiency by maybe 1 or 2 miles per gallon for obvious reasons, wasn't accepted in the marketplace. I think it's the expense and the highly competitive nature of that segment that's reduced it, but they are coming. It's going to happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Caleb is on the line now in Fort Worth. Hello, Caleb.
How are we doing today, ma'am?
Great, thank you.
Outstanding. Question I had is in regards to something I've heard. Mercedes in particular is using diesel vehicles in Europe and getting 70-plus miles to the gallon. If this is true, why are we not allowing this technology here in the States?
Good question. I think those mileage figures, though, are going to be for the much smaller Mercedes-Benz vehicles that aren't yet available in the U.S. Mercedes, all luxury car makers, but Mercedes itself has grappled with the notion of bringing their entire production spectrum into this marketplace because, frankly, they don't want to be perceived as a compact car maker. They want to be perceived as a luxury car maker. So what you're seeing with those 70 mile per gallon figures are vehicles like the A class and B class. And I understand that they are coming, so it can potentially will happen, but it hasn't happened today.
We had an email here from Rhonda who wanted to know what you think is the safest small car on the market, or maybe a range of safe small cars.
The good news is most of them are. Mm-hmm. Fiat makes a great argument for a very, very small footprint, but a structure that can hold up well in the event of a collision. But I think I would return to NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, see how many stars. I'd also go back to that active safety aspect, the visibility and the hip point. And to that end, things like the Honda Fit, where you can see out of them well, I think make a great deal of sense, as do most compact SUVs because of your higher hip point.
Are we going to get beyond the point where now cars are designed really well to sort of crumple if we get in an accident, so mm-hmm. we're okay and the car is totaled? Will we somehow not have to sacrifice the
structure,
salvation of the car?
Well, I think in trucks, and that I think is why there are so many truck fans, because they still are body-on-frame architectures, things that can be straightened out or unbolted as opposed to just disposing of the entire vehicle. Mm-hmm. So there's a rebuildability to the traditional truck that doesn't exist in today's car market.
Okay, the last thing I want to ask you about is what you have not yet had a chance to get into, to drive around, to experience that you're really, really dying to test.
The Bugatti has a 1.6 million car called the Veyron, and I suspect that would be good for an afternoon. More attainably, I would think that Cadillac's new ATS, which is a 3 Series competitor, looks very, very interesting from a production standpoint. And for all intents and purposes, any Porsche, whether I've driven it or not, I'd like to be able to revisit it.
All right. David Bolt is an automotive and business journalist and past president of the Texas Auto Writers Association. You can find his writing at Car Buzzard, and you can listen to his podcast. It's called Highway One. It's been wonderful to have you, as always. Thank you so much,
thanks very
Dave.
Much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free every day at kera.org/think. Email any questions, comments, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.